The time has come to get ready for the 2022 World Cup. And what better way to prepare than by revisiting the World Cup's most amazing goals? I'm Brian Phillips. I'm making a podcast about the history of the Men's World Cup, told through the stories of 22 iconic goals. The show's called 22 Goals. It's out now on the Ringer Podcast Network, and we're having so much fun.
This episode is brought to you by Major League Baseball. A lot is going on in the world of sports right now, but don't forget the 2024 baseball season. It's officially here. Some pretty exciting things to look forward to. Can the star-studded Dodgers, can they make the World Series? Can Mookie Betts break my heart again? How about the young Orioles? How about the defending champs, the Rangers, trying to become the first back-to-back champs in over two decades? See how far they'll go. Get in on the action by visiting your local ballpark or any ballpark, or you can just go to MLB.com, tap the banner to learn more. Baseball is something else. This episode is brought to you by Empower. You got money questions like, can I retire early? What are my best savings options? Can I afford to pay for my kids' education? Luckily, Empower has all the answers. With Empower's real-time dashboard and real live conversations, you get clarity on your real-life financial goals. So join 18 million Americans and Empower what's next. Start today at empower.com. Tap the banner or visit this episode's page to learn more. Sponsored by Empower, not an endorsement or a statement of satisfaction by a client.
Hello, media consumers. Welcome to PressBox Final Edition. Brian Curtis of The Ringer here, along with producer Erica Cervantes. Our guest today is a guy whose writing I have read and admired for a really long time, but outside of a couple of emails had never met until just now. He is Washington Post columnist Perry Bacon Jr. Perry, welcome to the Press Box.
Hey, Brian. Thanks for having me. I'm a big fan of you and your work, so I'm really happy to be here.
Few questions about your career before we dive into midterm talk. You worked at 538. You worked at MSNBC. What does having a column in the Washington Post offer you that's different from those jobs?
I'm laughing because whenever I'm on a plane or somewhere and I bump into like a person who's under 35, let's say, they'll usually say to me, "Oh, I recognize you. You were on the 538 podcast. I love when you were on that. I know you're at the Post now. I don't really read the Washington Post though." They'll just sort of say this, and I'm sort of like, "You're not supposed to say that." But this is my first role where I've been. I was a TV commentator, but I was, you know, hired as sort of a nonpartisan, non-ideological role. And I worked at 538, and our goal was to be pretty non-ideological there too. So this is the first job where I've been able to sort of let my opinions rip in a real way and be critical of, you know, I'm more on the left, so I'm critical, but I'm also critical of Democrats at times too. And so that's been the free part is you can really, and also you can sort of get up in the morning and pretty much choose, I want to write about local news in Louisville today, and I can do that versus waiting for some kind of, you know, quote unquote news peg. So that's been the fun part too. You have a lot of freedom, not just in terms of opinions, but in terms of choosing the topics.
That's what's so cool about having a column like yours, when so much of journalism, both on TV and online, is based on a thing happen, and I'm going to deliver a take about the thing within 30 minutes or an hour. But you can actually lead people to a topic that you think is important.
And I think there was a period maybe in 2010, let's say, where we only really had two takes, whatever the New York Times said, whatever the Washington Post said. Now we have whatever everyone on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, et cetera, said. We have Substacks, and we even have more opinion writing within. So I feel like and most people's takes are on what happened yesterday or what happened the day before. So in some ways, like the lane on some level is to sort of have a take about something that is not already part of the take-tocracy.
Speaking of those millennials who are doing nothing but listening to podcasts, how do you get people's attention with a newspaper column in 2022?
Let me know. But I think, you know, but the, you know, the Post is doing well and bringing people in. But I think it's often been when I write about something something that's offbeat. I wrote a piece when I first got the column being like, there's this critique of, you know, this idea that we're all living in bubbles. And I live in Louisville, Kentucky, so it's not a, you know, it's not a super Democratic area, but Hillary Clinton and Biden won here. And I looked in the New York Times in this feature where you can go look at your neighborhood's data. And I looked at my neighborhood, and my neighborhood is like 90-10 Biden voters. And so I wrote a piece being like, I live in a bubble and I'm fine with it. And I said something to the effect of, I think my neighbors are good people. We all voted for Joe Biden. We all took the vaccine. I'm not, you know, I think we're good people. I'm not too apologetic about that. And that one sort of caught on with a lot of people. You know, I had friends from college read that. People from all over really read that one. I think it sort of resonated. You know, obviously, I think diversity in all kinds and ideological diversity is important. There are some Republicans who live on my street who I see and we talk about things. And I think it's important. I think they're not really like Trumpy Republicans, to be totally honest, but I think that I respect other people's political views. I just don't necessarily think that you have to feel bad if you don't live in. But anyway, this piece did get out. I think if you pick something that's not about Biden, Pelosi, or Trump, then it tends to bring in sort of other audiences versus the post-core audiences, my sense is very invested in sort of the politics of today.
Bubble or not, does living in Kentucky lead you to write different columns than you'd write if you lived in Washington, D.C.?
Absolutely. I wrote a piece a few weeks ago that we're going to get to, I think, about kind of, so I grew up in Louisville, worked at the Courier Journal, the paper here. And so I spent a lot of time with the journalists, you know, in town. We have like a meeting every Tuesday, in fact, where we sort of have a happy hour. So I go to that and the journalists at the Courier Journal recently formed a union because the big owner of the paper there, the sort of corporation called Gannett that owns the paper, has all had all these cuts. And they were sort of talking about, and that sort of came up in a way that I don't think would have come up if I was in Washington. The bubble piece, I think it's different to be in a liberal area of a pretty contested state. I write about the sort of critical race theory or whatever, the sort of bans on talking about race or whatever, the passing in red states some, or abortion. This is happening where I live. So these are not like real life conversations, you know, these are not fictional things that are going on. Whereas you live in New York City, they're probably not going to ban abortion in New York City. So, you know, my wife and I were talking about like, you know, we both went to public school, but if the schools get to the point where they ban sort of honest discussion of racial issues, that would make me think about private school in a certain way. If our kid can actually learn about the world in a broader way than I would. And that's the kind of thing that I think happens if you're we're in a blue city. Also, you know, we were the place here where Breonna Taylor was shot by the police. That was a big national story. And you had sort of three blocks of people here. You had Republicans who were concerned about her killing, but also also generally inclined to defend the police. We had sort of a defund the police group. And then we had sort of people in the middle who were sort of sorting out, this was a tragedy that happened. And I think we have a more diverse political structure than in D.C., where they're, at least D.C. proper, in the city, there basically are no Republicans.
Let's talk about the midterms. We're 11 days out, that strange period where every day brings 9 different polls that go across Twitter and drive everybody right. completely insane. And then the story today about Nancy Pelosi's husband being attacked in an apparent home invasion in San Francisco. Is there a unified story of the midterms right now?
I think there is. I think I worked at 538, so I tend to look at these polling averages and think about it. So I think the unified story is, we all expect that, and I think everybody reading this stuff thinks Republicans will win the House and the Senate is a jump ball. And so I think it's useful and even though the polls shift and so on. So I think I think the question that is embedded in a lot of this coverage is, are we going to be in a wave election like 94 or 2006 or 2014 or 2018, where the president's party gets blown out and people in that party who we thought were safe end up losing? I think that's what the undercurrent is, or is something different happening? So that's one angle. That's the sort of, if you've covered politics a long time, you think that's what's happening. The other angle is this: we have no idea what's going on. The polls are constantly wrong. We're constantly wrong about everything. Just wait till it happens. And that's kind of how I've gotten to the point of like, I read the models and the models say this could be a red wave, but just wait. And what is the point of, if you're Nate Silver, predicting is what you should do, or like doing a prognostication or doing a, you know, a forecast, as he would say. But everybody else, we're not invested in necessarily our prognostication skills. And maybe we should sort of dial it back a little bit.
It really reminds me of the week before the Super Bowl, where readers have one question, which is who's going to win? And we don't know the answer to that question.
Yes.
But it is our incentive is to invest everything that happens between now and the Super Bowl or now and Election Day with meaning, because there are clicks to be had there. There's content to be had there. People are on edge. And then that drives us to do very weird things journalistically. You agree with that?
And just doing almost too many of them too. Just most people already knew who they were voting for months ago because they're in one of the two parties. The rest of them are probably deciding on things that already happened. There are very few people that switched their vote in the last 10 days, and we have no idea why. Like, we just, if you're a swing voter waiting until the 6 days before the election, you're sort of weird. Let's just not pretend here. Like, you know, it's not that you're a bad person, but it is like we've had 2 years for you to consider this thing between parties that have become incredibly divergent. What's going on with you? Like, if you actually talk to swing voters, this is interesting because they often don't follow politics closely and often have views that are sort of contradictory, that or like they don't fit, like they want to legalize marijuana but they want to build the wall too, that kind of thing, where it's like, you know, their views are not inconsistent, they're just like not in the sort of paradigm we think of everyone having their views in.
Which Senate race has interested you the most?
You know, I think what's happening in Pennsylvania is really interesting, where you know, I understand in a health sense, people have strokes. He's going to recover. He will probably be speaking again a different way. We should respect that. We should not be ableist, or we should not be critical of him for recovering. On the other hand, I am curious as a political observer, how do voters take that in? Like, and how do they, you know, we want people to not punish had a Fetterman for his health, but they might do so anyway. So I am watching that. In the same way, like, Raphael Warnock is an upstanding person who's the pastor of the church Martin Luther King once ran, is running against Herschel Walker, who has a lot of scandals, hasn't run for office before. But it's a very close race. And I think that goes to the fact that how strong partisanship is. And on some level, how Herschel Walker seems to be maybe not intellectually smart, but I get the sense, and I shouldn't say that, I don't mean to say he's dumb, I'm just saying he may not be a policy expert. He seems pretty savvy to me, and that's always what I'm interested in. I think we sort of overlay sort of, do you know a lot about like foreign policy with, are you a good candidate? And those are very, very different things, as President John Kerry could tell you. And so those are the two that I'm looking at probably a lot. The North Carolina race is interesting because it's a state that could become the sort of demographics of that state, big, educated, urban areas, high minority population. North Carolina is a state that should become Democratic, but it never is. And so I'm sort of watching to see that. Those are probably my three. The candidates, they're not as interesting, but I'm trying to watch that as a state, just looking forward to where it's headed.
Speaking of Georgia, Stacey Abrams is running for governor for the second time. Not to be poll person, but the polls have her running behind Brian Kemp, the Republican. How do you look back at Abrams's career with the two gubernatorial races and then back to her time in the Georgia House of Representatives?
So it looks like, from what I see, is Stacey Abrams is right about something, but it hasn't helped her. Is that I think her general view that the Georgia is a state Democrats can compete in was correct. Like, she was pushing the Democrats in 2020. You got to try to win this state, and sort of banging the drum. And that was smart. And her view of how to win it, which is like not necessarily to sort of move to the right, but to try to like figure out, there's all these people moving to Atlanta of all races, you know, young white people, Asians, black people, of course, and sort of maximize those people. I think those two insights, I think, were probably smart. She helped recruit Raphael Warnock. So I think that she helped them win the state. That said, I think she's going to end up having, you can be right about something and it not necessarily benefit you. And I get the sense that in 2018, she helped get the state closer, but doesn't win. And this time, I think it's worth considering that I think we're going to end up with a lot of races where when there was a challenge, when there was two people running and there was no incumbent, the Republican won. But in a lot of places, I think we're going to see the incumbent won, because all the evidence is that you get a 2 to 3 point advantage from being an incumbent, meaning that you are the sitting governor or the sitting senator. And I think we're going to look at a lot of these closer races and be like, okay, that incumbency thing we need to start thinking about more, because I think that's really, because Kemp and Warnock are the incumbents. And I think that's a very relevant point factor here.
Whenever I read your Washington Post chats you do with readers, Democratic-leaning readers, as they are wont to do online, Democrats say this all the time online, is the Democrats are screwing this up. This is the take, right? The election would be different if the Democrats weren't screwing this up. Do you think the Democrats are screwing this up?
I don't, in general. And I guess the thing I keep coming back to is we've had in the 20 midterm elections since 1942, the party in control of the presidency has lost the House in 18 of them. So on some level, one of my old colleagues, Nathaniel Rakish, great writer, 538, tweeted on November 6th, 2020, November 6th, 2020, no data on inflation or anything, congratulations to the Republicans for winning the midterms in 2022. Like, very apt. Biden had been declared the winner that day. And it was like, and the rule that the other party wins the midterms is one of the sort of laws of politics on some level. We don't really know exactly why that happens. We think it's because the voters kind of want to balance out the parties. But that's kind of, are the Democrats doing everything optimally? No. But I don't know what scenario looks like. The last time the president's party won the midterms was 2002, which was like right after 9/11. Bush is getting, you know, treated like sort of a unifying figure. His approval ratings are really high. It really takes something probably unique to get the incumbent party to win. I'm not saying the Democrats are blameless. I'm just saying that rule is pretty strong.
What's interesting is after that prescient tweet, we did have something fairly unique happen in American life, which is Donald Trump tried to steal the election. Rioters descended on the U.S. Capitol. Republicans' party, broadly speaking, did not reckon with that event, but tried to either shrug it off or install more helpful secretaries of state in various states around the country. And then what we are about to find out, we think, is that this iron law of politics still applies.
So if I agree. If the Democrats win the election, I think you would probably conclude that, oh, January 6th and maybe the Dobbs ruling broke this rule. But I think some of the, you know, there's these people who do these models of elections where they say, if you look at the president's approval in the economy, and these models suggest Democrats should lose about 40 House seats. And it looks like they may only lose 20. So it actually may be a complicated story where the Democrats lost the midterms as expected, but lost by less because some voters did recognize this Republican Party is a little bit extreme, just not enough. So I think there's a lot of things going on here at once. Again, I don't know the results yet, so I want to emphasize that the Democrats might win the House. But I'm looking at what I'm now is I think the law of politics is in practice, but also the Republicans probably have the Republicans would be favored in the Senate if they had not nominated Dr. Oz, Herschel Walker. If they had found whatever normal Chamber of Commerce person has been a House member for a long time, they would win 55 Senate seats, is my guess.
I would not blame anybody for being cynical about politics. If you could tell them January 6th will happen, just putting him inside Dobbs for a second, January 6th will happen. But then there are these immutable laws of politics that will kick in. And it's just going to happen. And I would say if I were a young person involved in politics, whatever, and I would be like, wait, what? I wouldn't blame them for being cynical. I'm probably cynical. We'll be cynical.
Cynical is a word. That's one word. I think we are really ideologically, I know this is not a political podcast, so I'm being careful here, but we are really divided ideologically. And I think for a lot of Republican voters, no, they didn't like January 6th. Of course, they think Trump lost. They have Republican policy views. The parties are really different. They don't think student loans should be forgiven. They don't want to have trillions of dollars spent for economic recovery or climate change mitigation. And I may think, of course, you should just vote Republican a few times. Just vote for Democrats because they are on the right side of democracy. They respect the laws. And they might say, well, this Republican I'm voting for this year did not participate in January 6th, and I'm a Republican and I'm a conservative. And I respect that. And I think that's part of it is like really that it's how divided we are politically. I started covering politics in 2004. I'm not saying it wasn't divisive, but I don't think people were, particularly Republicans, were scared to tell people who they voted for. Versus I think now, if you're a Trump voter in certain communities, you don't want to say, I think this is a problem with the polls, is I think you don't necessarily want to say, I'm a Trump. Billy, if you're college educated in a sort of a white collar job, you know, I don't think you want to say I'm a Republican or I'm a Trump voter, but I think they still feel that way. And I think it is, I don't know how you, I'm not saying it's good to be a Trump voter. I'm just saying this is where we are. And this kind of division is unhealthy. I'm not trying to be a both sides. I'm just saying this is not a great situation we're in now.
Regardless of what happens in the House, are you in favor of the Democrats rebooting their leadership there? Nancy Pelosi, Steny Hoyer, James Clyburn?
I am aggressively against that. Aggressively against that. So I wrote a piece, you know, in June or July saying, I've been covering politics 20 years. I've never covered a Democratic House leadership not led by Nancy Pelosi, Steny Hoyer, and James Clyburn. That just seems, you know, insane, particularly since their record, it's not like they've won every election. The Democrats have had I think they've lost more House elections than they've won under that trio. And so I just don't think you get, how many people get a 20-year tenure in charge of anything in America, particularly if their record is, like Bill Belichick should get a 20-year tenure. Look at his record. But I mean, but he's won the Super Bowl six times, but that's against 30, that's against 30 teams. Pelosi's only facing one other team and she constantly loses to it. So I don't even think it's an age problem. To me, it's like even when you see them interviewed, I don't think politics is changing and I'm not sure they are updating their views or their methods. Like I think Senator Warren is not necessarily that much younger than they are, but she's Bernie Sanders is older than they are. I just think that, you know, I'm more left wing. I wouldn't deny that, but it's also, I think that they are, but I just think who's in touch with movements, who's in touch with how politics is changing, that trio is not. And I'm not sure that Joe Biden should run either. I really think if you said to me, I don't want to go through another year like 2019 where there's 97 debates and I have to watch them all. That was horrible. But if you could get like Buttigieg or Cory Booker or Klobuchar or Gretchen Whitmer and just skip the debates or if there was a small field, not everybody and their mother running for president, but a small field of like younger folks, I think they might end up with a better person. Like I respect Joe Biden, but I don't think he's been fantastic. I think it's been a hard time, but I think a younger person might help and a person a little less stayed in their ways might help. And I guess he's going to be like 86 at the end of 2028. That is getting up there. I don't think it's ageist to say an 85-year-old may not be the best person for such a complicated country.
This episode is brought to you by Empower. You got money questions like, can I retire early? What are my best savings options? Can I afford to pay for my kids' education? Luckily, Empower has all the answers. With Empower's real-time dashboard and real live conversations, you get clarity on your real-life financial goals. So join 18 million Americans and Empower what's next. Start today at empower.com. Tap the banner or visit this episode's page to learn more. Sponsored by Empower, not an endorsement or a statement of satisfaction by a client.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Oh, such a clutch pickup, Dave.
I was worried we'd bring back the same team.
I meant those blackout motorized shades.
Blinds.com made it crazy affordable to replace our old blinds.
Hard to install?
No, it's easy. I installed these and then got some for my mom, too. She talked to a design consultant for free and scheduled a professional measure and install.
Hall of Fame son.
They're the number one online retailer of custom window coverings in the world.
Blinds.com is the GOAT.
The GOAT.
Go to Blinds.com for up to 45% off. Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Let me ask you about Twitter, which you wrote about the other day. Last night, Elon Musk completed his $44 billion purchase of Twitter and then celebrated by firing a bunch of top executives. What did you like about Twitter pre-Elon?
So, two things. The main thing is that if you know, if you don't work at the New York Times, the Ringer, the New York Times is different than the Ringer, obviously, but I mean the New York Times, the Post, the traditional news outlets, but even the newer ones like 538, where I worked, Vox, the Ringer, these are all great things. But there are plenty of smart people in America, in the world, who don't have a news media job. And to me, academics, activists, and to me, I find often that Twitter helps me find who is the expert or who's the smartest person or the person with a counterintuitive view on issue X or Y and who isn't writing in a big outlet. And it's been the easiest way for me to find those people. And it's really sort of expanded my universe of knowledge. I think that's how I found out about like Nate Duncan and now listen to his basketball podcast and I'm smarter about basketball. And so I just think that has been like, you know, to be blunt, I mean, Bill Simmons found some people for Grant Lynn and the Ringer who I hadn't heard of, but in some ways, but if there were seven more of the Ringers, there's a lot of talented people in the world who have a lot of smart things to say. And Twitter has expanded those for me. And to me, I know there's like, and also, Black Lives Matter started on Twitter. I mean, it happened. I think particularly for people whose views don't conform to establishment, I'll say white on some level occasionally, centrist. I think people whose views are kind of weird or outsidery, but are smart, aren't probably going to get jobs at the Post. We have diverse columnists. Let me put it that way, but we may not. But I think that outsider voices can be heard, and I find that to be super important. So, I hope that he understands that as a virtue. Is Twitter too left? I don't know. I think it depends on who you follow. Like there are plenty of Republicans on Twitter. I don't think that the ban stuff, like, I don't think I'm opposed to inciting violence. I'm also opposed to silencing political views. So I'm going to say something. I sort of hope Trump comes back, not because I know that I don't agree with Trump on pretty much anything, but I don't like the idea that the leader of a movement in the country is not, he should not incite violence on Twitter. But as long as he's just giving his views and his views are not ones I like, and some of the things he says can fall into a racist category, but I think that we should hear those views and debate them on some level. Maybe I'm thinking about this, but I agree with Elon Musk's idea that we don't want to silence people, but I don't know how that's going to be implemented.
Even if the views are the election was stolen from me over and over again, subversion of democracy, does that fall into the...
So that's the part that I think I'm just weighing this, like, is misinformation. I think if you say the vaccines don't cause you to die, that would be a place where I would be like, ban that. The election was stolen from a regular person. That's like almost a political view of sorts. The election was stolen by the sitting president is probably more like misinformation. I've got to think about this a little bit. I am not sure. And Twitter, unfortunately, is a private company, but has become something of a public space, Facebook too. And so, if we should not have privatized the public square, but I don't want to ban too many people from the public square.
I've already seen people saying they're going to leave Twitter if Musk fully turns it into whatever vision he has of it, which my old colleague Jay Kang compared to people threatening to move to Canada if Donald Trump was reelected. Or you have any plans to leave Twitter?
No, I don't have any plans to leave Twitter. And I hope people stay. I mean, yeah, I mean, obviously, if it becomes like a haven of bots and people threatening people's lives and that kind of thing, I don't know what it's going to be. I don't know much about Elon Musk, to be honest with you, but I'm probably not going to leave. I find Twitter super useful. I'm on the high end of users. I think it's improved my knowledge of the world. If I go off of it, I will look for some alternative. I'm like, you know, I might like Twitter more than its owner does at this point. So.
We talk a lot about local news here on the Press Box. And earlier this month, you floated a plan, admittedly a pie in the sky plan, but it's a plan. Mm-hmm. What is your plan for helping save local news?
So the plan is really pie in the sky in that I suggested that we should put $10 billion in local news. I, of course, left out the part of whose money would that come from? But and who's, so that was a big detail. I actually think there is some idea that you could, like, our, you know, a lot of countries are, you know, my plan called for like $10 billion, which is like a lot of money, but it's only like $30 a person. So one thing I am more open to, other countries have a fair amount, like much higher levels of per capita public giving to media than $30. So I think one version of that would be public financing of media, the way we fund like off a lot of scientific research, for example. I understand why you... You know, I don't want Ron DeSantis, you know, editing my stories either. But I think there is something to be said for if you can make it a public service. And the other way to think about this is, rather than thinking about this in this big national way, to think about every individual community, do you have the money there in some communities like where you have a couple... There's not a Jeff Bezos in every community, but there probably is someone who has a lot of money who can maybe help support a news site. Or ideally, like most cities, major cities have a NPR affiliate that is taxpayer funded. So it's not that far from that. So that was the kind of the big idea. But the big idea, what I was more focused on was sort of some principles for this journalism itself. And I had like five of them. That you should have news in every community, meaning that we should, right now, news is becoming a thing you have in urban areas and not in rural or ex-urban ones. All news, you know, every city should have some amount of like multi-platform news, meaning that an in-depth news, meaning that you should have a police beat reporter in every community. Whether they do their stories via tweet, Instagram, TikTok, or article, I don't care, but somebody should cover the core beats in every community. So that's the second thing. The third was nonprofit, because I think local news is not going to make money anymore. Another idea I had, this is a sort of a more of the fourth idea I had, was that it should be free. And I know that's a controversial idea, but I think we need local news to be able to reach people. And I think a big problem with our current environment is most of the in-depth news, including where I work at, is behind a paywall. You should go to a college campus and ask kids about paywalls. They're like, what are you talking about? Yeah. So that's a big problem. And the fifth thing that I said was we need to have more local news with a point of view. And what I suggested was essentially having kind of every community have sort of a New York Times, NPR-ish, trying to reach everybody kind of news outlet. I know that there are debates about whether those are left or whatever. And then have an outlet that is maybe more... that has sort of like pro-LGBT, pro-racial equality, sort of a more left-wing-ish thing, and then have a more capitalism is good, you know, religion is good. I'm not saying these views are all in one party, but having more sort of a right-wing one too and everything. Because I think that we are learning that people like news that, like, there's a nightly experiment, and Fox News and MSNBC suggest that they get more audience than CNN, which tells me people want news from a perspective that they already align with, and maybe we should sort of respect them a certain way.
And this is in every congressional district in America. It's going to have, and under the Perry Bacon plan, it's going to have a newspaper-like object that's going to cover all these beats, whether it's actually an article form or not.
Yeah, right.
And it's going to have a National Review-like object, and then it's going to have an American Prospect, essentially.
That's essentially it. Yeah, well put. Yes, exactly.
Okay,
yes.
So we have three things.
Three things. So I said, so the idea would be the big one would be trying to reach everybody, and it would have 100 people. And that means TikTokers, journalists, whatever, 100 people at one of them, and then 50 at the other two, the left wing and the National Review, and the, because I think the 100 person is trying to reach all the people, so it needs to be bigger. So that was the kind of, in every congressional district. So that was, in any way, you add that up, I think you add it up to, that's like 200 journalists, 435 districts, you end up at a lot of money very quickly. So yeah, that was the Perry Bacon plan. Yeah.
All right, last one for you, Perry. We're doing a media movie countdown here on the Press Box. Recent, old, new, everything. Favorite media movies. Do you have a nominee for our list?
So I'm going to give two. So the first is, and this will be made fun of, I think. I'm a cheesy, idealistic person. And the first few episodes of The Newsroom, the HBO Aaron Sorkin show, which got worse as it went on, but the first few episodes are very pure. Here's what journalism's function in the world can be. It can be a force of good. There's real debates about that. Mm-hmm. I sometimes go back and watch the first episode to sort of review, what am I doing this for? Why is this important? What can we do? And so The Newsroom is one. And then, because I was working in TV news at the time, there's a show called Being Mary Jane, in which Gabrielle Union plays a cable news journalist. This was a show 2015 to 2019 or so. And that one I thought was, it was good in that it often captured like the real elements of what's going on in news media, which is like people elbowing to even their friends to be on TV more. TV is very zero sum. The basic view being if this person succeeds and I'm failing because the TV slots are very limited. The newspaper has, you know, thousands of employees often, but the TV, they're only going to put on a certain number of people, and it's very, you know, friends one day or enemies the next. And I think that show really, I mean, that show was realistic enough to where I stopped watching it, in part because that happened at work and I did not enjoy when that happened at work. And so it was, that one was really good as well. Newsroom, though, is a more happy version of it.
I'm so happy to hear you're pro Newsroom. There's no need for us to hide. You know, it's okay.
When it was going off, I felt like I had to hide because if it came, Sorkin shows have their problems. I get that. But I actually sort of, if you go back and watch West Wing, the politics are stupid, but the character development and the idealism, I think we sort of need more of that in a certain way.
There are a lot of people who think Alan Alda should be the Republican nominee for president.
I mean, I went back and looked at that, like Jimmy Smits and Alan Alda, that would have been, that was a great election. It was, you know, it's actually interesting is, it wasn't that different than McCain and Romney. I mean, McCain and Obama, right? It was very similar to that in a certain way. And so that's kind of what when I think about the world, I just want to go back to Obama versus McCain. And I know we're never going back, but that's all because McCain was somebody, I'm left of center, obviously, but McCain was someone who, if they were the president, I would have been pretty proud of and thought was a great person. And so it's sort of hard to think that we're so far from that, but we are so far from that.
All right, you can read Perry Bacon's column in the Washington Post. Perry, thanks so much for coming on the Press Box.
Hey, Brian, thanks for having me.
All right, it's time for the second weekly edition of David Shoemaker Guesses the Strain Pun Headline.
Yeah.
Monday's headline about Don Lemon's move from primetime to mornings on CNN was, now it's Don Lemon, D-A-W-N. Today's headline comes from the Sydney Morning Herald. It's a story about chess. A 19-year-old beat the reigning chess world champion, and there were some intimations of cheating. The 19-year-old has now filed a defamation suit. But let's stick to the basic facts here, David. 19-year-old involved in a high-stakes, somewhat controversial chess match. What was the Sydney Morning Herald's strained pun headline?
Controversial chess match. This is like a checkmate. I mean, is there how many chess phrases? King.
Remember
jack,
whenever jack, you're at a loss, go to the last great pop culture thing.
Queen's
about
Gambit. Teen's Gambit.
A Teen's Gambit.
Yeah.
Teen's Gambit. By the way, this was also a headline rule of three. The subhead was a chess cheating scandal, a sex toy, and Elon Musk.
Dang. Now I want to read it. Way to go, headline rule of three.
Yeah, the same one. He is David Shoemaker. I'm Brian Curtis. Production magic by Erica Cervantes. Back Monday with more lukewarm takes about the media. See you then, David.
See you later, Brian.